Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests, and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now, here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, everybody, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is Bruce Ash welcoming you to a special all-China edition of Inside Track. As always, thank you so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, and Corazon Cabinets. These are great local companies you should do business with. Talking about companies you should be doing business with, Corazon Cabinets is your locally owned source for high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets, all at wholesale prices. Joy, Kelly, and Jennifer can help you design your dream kitchen or bath area. Corazon Cabinets carries J&K, Conestoga, and now Medallion Cabinets. Come by and visit the showroom soon. See our displays of what your home will look like with Corazon Cabinets. We are one of the few suppliers of Medallion Cabinets anywhere in Southern Arizona. I just saw one of our newest installations, and it looks like our client's kitchen should be an architectural digest. Call 488-2266 and let them know you heard this ad on Inside Track to get an additional 5% discount on Corazon's already low wholesale prices. You'll be amazed by the great styles and super low prices at Corazon Cabinets. We have a great show for you today. We focus on the China trade negotiations and the freedom crisis in Hong Kong. After we return from our first break, we'll hear from Trump administration advisor and spokesman Andy Puzder on his recent Wall Street Journal piece he co-authored with former Missouri Senator Jim Talent on why it is so important for China to make a deal with America at this time and the problematic issue of sanctions and enforcement of trade cheating and theft of intellectual properties, which is at the core of the remaining status of negotiations. After we talk with Andy, Dennis Kwok, leader of the freedom movement in Hong Kong, will join us. Dennis and fellow legislative council member Alvin Yeo are in the United States meeting with high-ranking government officials and a bipartisan congressional and Senate group from both parties. As you may recall, the conscience of Hong Kong, Anson Chang, has appeared on our show earlier in the spring, before the recent crisis over extradition legislation developed. Dennis Kwok is the successor to Mrs. Chang and represents millions of Hong Kongers who are fighting for their basic human and political rights, which are being taken away from them by the Chinese government, despite the guarantees contained in the Sino-British Separation Agreement and subsequent so-called Basic Agreement, which assured a one country, two systems for Hong Kongers. Also appearing with Dennis will be RNC member and escapee himself from China's repressive regime, Solomon Yu. Stay tuned. This is a show unlike any you'll hear on local radio here in Tucson. This is Bruce Ash. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. Our special guest for the next two segments is Andy Puzder. Andy has written a great Wall Street Journal opinion piece with former Missouri Senator Jim Talent regarding the trade negotiations that are going on right now with China and some of the difficulties and the opportunities that exist. Welcome to the show with me on Inside Track, Andy.
Great to be here, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
You wrote, as I said, a recent op-ed piece, "The Trade War Hits China Where It Hurts." I know you didn't specifically write the headline, but I'm sure you would agree with the headline. The trade war really is hurting China at this time, isn't it?
It is. China's at a kind of a weak moment. I don't think it's popularly perceived this way, but I think our article was one of a few that are out there arguing that the Chinese emperor has no clothes. China's had problems coming for years. When they implemented what they call red capitalism, which is a really state-run capitalism, it really helped the Chinese people initially, but as with most socialist governments, they are reluctant to give up power. They've never set up an independent judiciary. They never set up an independent banking system. Their economy, about a third of it, is controlled by state-operated entities. which are owned by members of the Politburo and have turned them all into billionaires. So there's a lot of government control in their economy, and it's been slowing growth for a long time. The way they've been able to continue to grow is by taking advantage of the world trading system and manipulating their currency. And President Trump has stepped up and said, enough is enough. We're stopping this. So I think that the tariffs are hitting China at a time when it's particularly vulnerable, and I think that's a good thing for the United States.
So I'm a member of the Republican National Committee, the committeeman from Arizona. And at the 2019 RNC summer meetings, I sponsored a resolution in support of President Trump's China trade policy. You would agree that really all Americans need to get behind our efforts to fix what has really been a terribly broken trade sort of relationship between the United States and China, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's time that Americans realize that, look, if we wait another 10 years, we may not be able to stop the onslaught of China and the economy. We've got some serious problems with China. They've been stealing technology. They've been taking our trade secrets. They've been hacking into our systems. They've underpricing products on the international market so as to drive American companies out of business or make it difficult for them to survive. And no president prior to President Trump has really taken aggressive action to stop that. In fact, President Obama asked, you may recall during the campaign, he quoted candidate Trump as saying that he was going to renegotiate these deals. And Obama said, well, you know, what magic wand do you have to do that? Well, you know, as it turns out, tariffs aren't a magic wand, but having a president willing to implement them is a magic wand, and we finally have one. We need to stand behind him.
The president has described China's economy as the, quote, the greatest theft of history in the world. I'm sure you agree with that, but why is it so many people really don't understand that what they've been doing really constitutes great theft that's been going on for probably the last two or three decades since, and certainly since they joined the WTO early in this century?
I think people are, it's a little difficult for people to see the long-term detrimental effect of what's going on with China. And I think it becomes more difficult when we've got a left-leaning press that's trying to push the China narrative. And we've also got large American businesses that make huge profits off their relationship with China. And they're reluctant to criticize China publicly. So what you end up with is a situation where people really aren't getting the right information. If they were, I think they'd be more aware that China's out to get us. China's out to take over our position as the world's dominant economy. That would put a totalitarian state at the peak of a world preeminence, and that would be a bad thing for personal liberty and economic freedom. And it's hard for people just when they're paying, you know, I don't know, $10, $15, $20, $30, $40 less for their iPhones or their laptop computers, or, you know, we'd get cheap rubber bands and rubber rafts. I mean, you look at the benefits, it's easy to see the benefits because you're spending less money for goods that these Chinese workers are producing with very low hourly rates and that the Chinese government subsidizes by manipulating their currency and by underpricing to kill other businesses. It's easy to see those, but it's hard to see the long-term consequences. I think President Trump does. I think a lot of Americans do, by the way. The farmers in Iowa last week, I think, were pretty clear that even though they're going to take the brunt of this trade war. They support the president's actions. They don't like it, but they know we need to do it. And I think the American people need to understand that as well and get behind it.
And really, you talk about the farmers in Iowa, Andy. That's really the latest sort of example how Chinese leaders have made an agreement with the president and his team to buy soy product and other products from American farmers. And no sooner do they do that, they renege on it. And now they leave our farmers vulnerable because they didn't do what they said they'd do.
On things it agrees to, which is why I think it's very important for our trade representatives to make sure that whatever agreement we enter into with the Chinese has enforcement mechanisms. And I know, you know, Lighthizer, Mnuchin, Navarro, they're all very aware of this. And but it does slow negotiations. But thank God we have a president who's not going to rush these negotiations for some, you know, political benefit. He wants substantive improvement. I think when the Chinese realize that, we'll get an agreement a lot quicker. But at the moment, I think they're still wondering if they can push this president around, if they can push the American people around, with an election pending, and maybe they'll end up with one of those, I don't know, whether 22 of them on the debate stage, all of whom would be willing to give China a better deal for political considerations. This president is unwilling to do that, so they may be seeing if they can wait.
So let me see if I get this straight. The Chinese sell below their cost. I'm in business myself. That's what I do. How long can anybody, much less the Chinese, afford to produce products and sell them at less than cost and afford to continue doing that?
Well, you can't do it forever, but you probably, if you've got enough money, and the Chinese have a lot of money right now, if you do it long enough, you can do it. You can put your competitor out of business. You know, this is what Rockefeller was accused of doing around the turn of the century when Teddy Roosevelt did all that trust busting. He was accused of underpricing oil in certain markets to put his competitors out of business. They put him out of business, and he raised the prices so that he made more money. That's why you want to get rid of your competitors. And I think China's just trying to position itself where it can control prices, much like a monopoly would. And President Trump's out there to stop them before they get the ability to do so.
And so the president has talked in quite a number of different settings, Andy, about how we place very, very low tariffs, if any, on products coming from other countries. You know, let's say a 5% tariff or a 2% tariff versus 10, 15, 20, 25% tariffs on our products going into their countries. China has sort of a similar situation, I think, if you might confirm that. For example, U.S. automobiles, we do produce cars and trucks in China, but there are tariffs placed on those products and certainly products that are manufactured in the United States and go to China. How does that work?
Just so everybody's aware of this, the largest car-producing nation in the world is China, and they far outproduce the United States or Europe. And that's been the case for years. And China is starting to look at markets outside of China for the sale of its automobiles. Now, let's say you're the president of Ford or the president of General Motors. If you want to sell, let's say Ford, if you want to sell a Ford in Berlin, you pay a 10% tariff. If Mercedes wants to sell the Mercedes in Detroit, they pay a 2.5% tariff. Well, that's going to allow Mercedes to outcompete the United States worldwide. With China, if you want to sell a Ford in Beijing or Shanghai, you pay a 25% tariff. If the Chinese want to sell a Chinese automobile in Detroit, they pay a 2.5% tariff. If you're running a car company, you got to realize, you know, you're really getting taken advantage of by the international trading system. And I think we need a president to stand up to those tariffs and stand up to those countries. And look, we're not going to let you sell your goods here in the strongest and most profitable market in the world. And then when we try and sell our goods in your country, you charge us exorbitant tariffs. That's just not going to work. Thank God we finally have somebody who's willing to stand up to those countries in President Trump.
Andy, let's go ahead. We're going to take a real quick break, get some commercials in, and then when we come back, we'll continue our conversation on our trade disagreement with China right now. And we're going to talk about first the GDP differences on China. So stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back with Andy Puzner. You're listening to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track. Bruce Ash here with Andy Puzner. And we were just talking about China and some of the things that they do to restrict U.S. goods, put greater tariffs on them. This has sort of become the status quo. What is also the status quo, and it's really interesting, you pointed this out with Jim Talent in your opinion piece, the China GDP is at $10,000. Now, that's lower than even Romania. Their neighbors in Taiwan have a $26,000 GDP, and the U.S. GDP is $62,000. Where is this great Chinese economy?
Those numbers are obviously per person.
Yeah.
So if you're living in China and the GDP per person is $10,000, you can look to Hong Kong. You don't have to look very far. You can see Hong Kong where the GDP per person is $49,000. So this is one of the reasons that people in Hong Kong are so upset as China tries to integrate Hong Kong more into the Chinese society and the Chinese economy. They know they're going to be losers. And so you really need very, very, very significant growth in China to take a 10,000 per person GDP and raise it even to Taiwan's at 26, let alone South Korea, Japan, or Hong Kong at 49, or the U.S. at $62,000. You need very, very substantial economic growth. Now, they've had strong economic growth for about 20 years. Now, we don't know for sure that the numbers they're reporting are accurate numbers. They, very famously, the Chinese, since they control the economy and they control the numbers, they distort them or outright lie about them to try and make themselves look better. For example, they're now reporting 6% GDP growth, which sounds substantial. The United States would like to be at 3%. But they're reporting 6%. I suspect, and Jim Talent does as well, that they're probably closer to zero. It may be 0 to 1% rather than 6%. But even at 6%, it's going to take them decades to catch up to their neighbors in economic growth per person or GDP per capita. So the Chinese people, when there's not economic growth, there's great discontent. There's incredible income inequality in China. There's incredible poverty. As you noted, they've got GDP per capita comparable to Romania, and it's actually comparable to Greece. I mean, this is a rich country in the sense that the people at the top have a lot of money, but it is really a very poor country when you compare it to others across the globe.
Well, which is your typical communist or socialist model. So Hong Kong has become really a flashpoint, and it does sort of typify really what the Chinese government is all about. You know, it occurs to me, and I've traveled frequently to Hong Kong and also Taiwan, but I have loads of friends in Hong Kong who've actually been part of the umbrella movement. Anson Chang, for one, who led that movement back in 2014, is a friend of mine. And all they need to do in Hong Kong, Andy, is to agree to do what they said they would do originally with respect to one man, one vote. And they just seem to be incapable of doing that. And they're willing to really crash that entire state in order to press on with their totalitarian ways. You know, the whole world is watching. There was probably 75,000 of the protesters who shut down the Hong Kong airport. I mean, this is really becoming quite a difficult sort of a situation for the Chinese to manage, and they don't seem to be managing it very well.
Well, this is a socialist government that inevitably, and of course it is also a totalitarian government, because socialist governments inevitably become totalitarian governments, and they are unwilling to give up power. These people at the top, these billionaires on the Politburo that control the state-operated entities, they're not willing to give up power. And they know the Chinese people are, you know, Chinese people are getting out of China now. They're able to travel. They're able to pick up some TV from neighboring countries. They can see that life is better in their capitalist neighbors, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea. You know, people know there's a better life. And if Hong Kong is allowed to survive in its current form, it just stands as direct evidence of the failure of the Chinese economic model and the success of the capitalist economic model. And the Chinese totalitarian government, the members of the Politburo, are having a very difficult time with that.
Yeah, so in addition to the problems in Hong Kong, we know about the re-education camps and what really amount to concentration camps in northwest China, as well as another horrific thing with organ harvesting. I mean, what kind of a civilized society has involuntary organ harvesting as a state policy? It's unbelievable. Let's move on. The tariffs really are winning. Manufacturing and tech are leaving China. Retailers are pulling out. Chinese factory productivity has been down 3 months in a row. They've lost 5 million jobs just in the past year. Imports down by 5.6% in July. China now is our third leading trade partner. What's in the forecast? We obviously, in the United States, I mean, we're concerned, everybody is concerned about this trade thing that's going on. But this is a pretty critical problem for the leaders in China right now. These are dangerous numbers for them to have to contend with.
They are dangerous numbers, and they do have problems with keeping the populace under control, particularly. And the worse the problems get, the tighter they seem to increase their grip, where they probably could solve a lot of their economic problems, at least reduce the problems by releasing their economic totalitarian grip, by giving more. The Chinese are very entrepreneurial people. I think if the Chinese government would let them do what they can do, I think they'd be seeing much more success than they're seeing. But there's great fear at the top that they're going to lose power, that the economic model that they've been pursuing will not be successful. And I think the Chinese have to come to an agreement with us at some point. Now, they do take a very long-term view towards economic and political issues. I think President Xi Jinping still has kind of a Han Dynasty view of life, where China was the world's dominant power. I don't know that they'll give up on that, but I do think they're going to realize at some point that they have to cut a deal with the United States to stave off further difficulties. And the sooner they do that, the sooner they realize that President Trump's in office. He's not going to budge for political reasons. He's going to fight for a substantive good deal for America. The sooner they realize that, the sooner we can move on and get something reasonable done. But again, it's got to be something we can enforce.
Mm-hmm. Other countries are replacing China as a manufacturing resource, a foreign manufacturing resource. Where are U.S. companies moving to? I mean, would it be Vietnam or Singapore? I mean, where are the future companies looking to relocate, knowing that China may not have the best sort of atmosphere and environment for them?
Well, some of this has been going on for a while. We were the first company when I ran CKE to open up restaurants in Vietnam. We opened up Carl's Jr. in Saigon. I visited the restaurants, and when I was at the hotel checking in, people kept asking me if I was in the garment industry, because a lot of Americans were going there as the garment industry was moving manufacturing from China to Vietnam because the labor in Vietnam was actually less expensive than it was in China. So you're seeing a lot of companies move to Vietnam, to Malaysia. There are plenty of countries in Southeast Asia where the manufacturing that's done in China could be moved that are not a huge threat to the United States and where we do not have these ridiculous tariff problems. So I think you're seeing not only tech move, but other retail and wholesale manufacturing is leaving China. And again, that's going to be very hurtful to their economy.
One last question. So the devaluing of the currency that went on last week, and I guess there's been some easing on that subsequently, but why did the Chinese feel that they needed to do that? And what was the effect on the, say, the affordability of their goods here in America?
Well, obviously they did it because they want their goods to remain competitive on price. They want them to be able to be below, at or below the price of goods coming out of other countries. So let's say, for example, you were paying $10 for something from China, and our government imposed a 10% tariff, so you think that would go up to $11. And therefore, the American company would have to pay $11 for something it was previously paying $10 for. When you devalue the currency, let's say you then devalue your currency 10%, well, now you only pay $9 to buy that same product from China. It's the same price in the yuan, but since the yuan's been devalued, you don't need as many dollars to purchase it. So now you've got a $9 product where you're paying a 90-cent tariff, so you're paying $9.90 for something you formerly paid $10 for. Obviously, that way China can deal with the tariffs without causing the people in America who purchase their products to pay a higher price. So the more they can do that, the more they can offset the tariffs. The problem is that then if the Chinese want to buy goods from other countries, since the dollar is the world's currency, their currency is now worth less, so they have to pay more to buy goods from other countries, which hurts their economy. Plus, countries don't want to invest in China because the currency has been devalued. So there's harm to China, but so far they've been able to offset. This is why you see inflation is not very high. Inflation, I think it was 1.4% last year. I think recently we've seen it go up. Maybe it's 2%, which is the Fed's target. That's very, very low inflation. And the reason we haven't seen the price increases is because the Chinese have been absorbing through deflating their currency the harm that would otherwise have been done to them by the tariffs.
Andy, thank you very much for spending time with us. I've been an Andy admirer from afar for quite a while. It's a shame that you weren't able to join the administration in, let's just say, an official role. But the work that you've been doing, and it's nice to see you and Jim Towne collaborating on this piece with the Wall Street Journal, is very, very valuable. Lots of people read it. And thanks very, very much for talking to us on Inside Track.
Great to be here, Bruce. Thank you. And I've been an admirer of yours as well. Keep it up there in Arizona. Keep up the fight.
All right. Thanks very much. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Our special guests for the rest of the show today are Dennis Kwok and Solomon Yu. Dennis is a founding member of Hong Kong Civic Party and a member of the Hong Kong Legislative Council, where he holds a leadership position. Mr. Kwok is a lawyer and a champion for basic freedoms in Hong Kong. He and his colleagues in the Civic Party are the tip of the spear in the current showdown for the pro-democracy movement in their battle with the People's Republic of China. Joining Dennis is former escapee from communist Chinese tyranny himself, longtime pro-freedom advocate, Oregon's Republican National Committeeman, Solomon Yu. Now, just as a little bit of background, after 156 years of colonial rule, Great Britain returned Hong Kong to the communist government on mainland China in 1997 to set up Hong Kong as a special administrative region and developed a construct, if you will, for governing the former British colony known as the Basic Agreement that was based on one country, two systems. While there has been some political tension from the start, a pro-democracy movement developed in earnest with the umbrella demonstrations in 2014. From censorship curtailment of academic freedoms, judicial system undermining, immigration restrictions, freedom of movement, one man, one vote, and recently, an oppressive extradition policy. Freedom in Hong Kong, or the lack of it, have been a focus for us here on Inside Track for some time. Earlier this year, the conscience of Hong Kong, Anson Chang, was our guest here. The Hong Kong story is important because Americans have great concern how China is becoming a threat to democracy and freedom in Hong Kong, on the mainland, and around the world. Dennis and Solomon, welcome to Inside Track.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's get right to it. Dennis, you and your colleague Alvin Yeo have met in D.C. with officials there about the current issues in Hong Kong. What can you tell us about your meetings?
I think the message from both the Republican and the Democratic Party, senators, congressmen, are very clear that they are very concerned about the situation in Hong Kong. They want Hong Kong to remain free, open, and an international city based on the rule of law. And they're concerned that the Chinese government is walking back on their word in the Sino-British Joint Declaration, because so far, full democracy, as promised, has not been given to the Hong Kong people. And these protests are basically all the discontent, all the complaints that the Hong Kong people has had in the past 20 years are coming to a head. Especially the young people, they will no longer tolerate the current state of government.
Deng Xiaoping proposed and designed basic freedoms that your colleague, Alvin, said, all we want is democracy promised under basic law. Now, I don't want to misquote him or take his comments at the Asian Society out of context, but the problem today really is China is not living up to the basic framework of their agreement. It's not that you're looking for more than what the basic agreement called for. They're not living up to the basic agreement at all, are they?
No, they have not given Hong Kong people democracy, universal suffrage, as promised under the basic law, our constitution. And on top of that, we're seeing our freedoms being encroached upon further and further. They're disqualifying people from standing for public office. They are canceling political groups, and they are prosecuting democratic leaders for criminal offenses. So I think all those in combination means that Hong Kong is now at a crossroad. Are we going to continue to go south? Is the situation going to get worse? Or are we going to go on a new path where China will finally honor its democratic promise to the Hong Kong people? Now, the key, us being here in America, is to tell our friends in Congress and State Department and in here in Oregon is that we are hoping that the American people will understand that Hong Kong is very important. It is very important to America. It is very important to the world. And it is important for Hong Kong to stay free and open.
So what exactly were the expectations under the basic law? What kind of a society and what type of freedoms were guaranteed through the basic agreement?
Apart from the basic human rights, freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom to stand for election, we were also guaranteed that at some point we will have full universal suffrage, meaning that our legislature would be fully democratically elected, and also the chief executive, the leader of the Hong Kong government, will also be elected by the Hong Kong people. But unfortunately, up to this point, that promise has not been fulfilled.
So have the Chinese government observed the construct of the basic law, what sort of powers would the Legislative Council have to govern in Hong Kong, especially in view of the fact that there is an administrator, if you will, I think that's Connie Lam at this time, who is essentially appointed by the Chinese mainland, isn't she?
Well, Ms. Lam was elected by a committee of 1,200 people, and out of the 1,200 people, most are basically the appointees of or representatives of Beijing, and they basically listen to what Beijing tells them to do. So Beijing controls the process of the selection of the chief executive, and the will of the Hong Kong people has very little to do with the process. In fact, most Hong Kong people cannot participate in that process. And they have tried to put forward democratic reform packages in Hong Kong, but the package was so far short of public expectation. Basically, the package they put forward was that the Communist Party in China will choose the candidate for the Hong Kong people to vote on. And that is obviously not good enough.
Was that the intent of the basic law?
No, the basic law guarantees universal suffrage. Universal suffrage in its full meaning, meaning that the Hong Kong people will, through a democratic process, elect their own leader and also their own legislative representative. This has not happened. And the point is this, Bruce. If China can walk back on international agreements like the Sino-British Joint Declaration or not honor the basic law, can the rest of the world really trust to have a deal with China? You know, I know your country is having U.S.-China trade negotiations. Now, I hope it will go well. But the thing is, at the end of the day, whatever deal you have with the Chinese government, can you trust them to honor that deal? I think Hong Kong is a test for that commitment.
Solomon, you, as I described before, were an escapee from communist China. You probably had a kill order on you had they been able to get a hold of you. As you look at what's going on right now in Hong Kong, based upon your experiences, what are your thoughts about this movement and its success of achieving a restoration of rights as intended under the basic law?
Bruce, I have great hope for Hong Kong democracy and human rights, also for their universal suffrage. As a matter of fact, because demonstrations and because demonstrators registered a lot of Hong Kong voters. So if you take a look, November district council elections are coming up, and with this kind of anger, and they can capture lots of seats for democracy activists, okay? And that is their democratic path to democratic future, including universal suffrage. And I see a lot of good things happening. And even though, as you know, and some of our friends, including Anson Pen and Dennis, happen to be on this secret arrest list. And so we have to be very much concerned about that, their safety, on one hand. On the other hand, I'm so happy that President took a very, very strong stand. President tweeted, if there is a Tiananmen Square-style crackdown, that goes negotiation with China, period. Now, for President, it's really a big deal. The reason is, he is a person who put a lot of time, efforts on trade negotiation. And now for him to realize US must put Hong Kong human rights, Hong Kong freedom, Hong Kong democracy before trading with China. That really is a big deal. So I see hope, okay? I see there is a democratic path to that victory. Back to Dennis now.
Dennis, earlier this week, I think it was earlier this week, you and your colleague Alvin Yeo participated in a talk at the Asia Society. I'd like to play a clip from that for us to listen to. I think it's very instructive to our listeners. Let's try to get that cued.
Thank you. Bro, democracy values. We are not talking about something so abstract that is not happening. In fact, Hong Kong has been practicing liberal democracy values over the past 100 years. That makes Hong Kong successful, in fact. And how are we going to sustain and protect an international financial center? We need all these values, including free flow of information, freedom of movement, freedom of speech, and also, most importantly, the rule of law. These are also essential to sustain this international financial center, and they happen to be liberal democracy values. And if China is so against it, then why on earth in the first place they promised one country, two systems, and take full advantage of this system over the past 20 years? So again, Hong Kong people are not asking for the moon. We are simply asking for something that was promised in the basic law.
And remember, Deng Xiaoping proposed one country, two systems, and not only as a solution for Hong Kong, but also potentially for Taiwan. But guess what? Our Taiwanese friends are not buying it. You know, they look at Hong Kong and say, we ain't buying one country, two system, because we don't want tear gas or expired tear gas, you know, and rubber bullets to be shot at our younger generation. So if someone is thinking about this strategically, it will be in the interest of China as a whole if one country, two system, as originally designed, is to work in that way, that would actually be intricately linked and helpful to the Taiwanese situation as well. But hey, you know, the Taiwanese people, they're looking at Hong Kong. I have every sympathy for these.
So that was your talk before the Asia Society just recently.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the freedom of the protesters. There are a number of these protesters, I believe, through the news reports, who are in jail at this time. Do we know about how many and what their treatment and what their conditions are at this time?
Well, the situation is worrying. You know, you have seen pictures of police firing tons of tear gas into the crowd, firing open rounds of rubber bullets to young people. And so far, we know that over 700 people have been arrested. Some of them have been charged with rioting, which is a serious criminal offense that could carry a maximum sentence of 10 years. And we have seen triads being used, mobsters, gangsters being used to attack ordinary Hong Kong citizens in collusion with the Hong Kong police. Now, we've never seen anything like that in Hong Kong's history. And, you know, they are mobilizing the PLA across the border. I think everyone knows this is a threat that they are trying to pose to the Hong Kong people. But the Hong Kong people have so far stand resolutely firm and committed to their ideals. And their ideals are very realistic and reasonable, which is universal suffrage, a full withdrawal of the extradition bill, and also the setting up of an independent commission of inquiry to look into the recent events. So these are what they are asking for. And I think a government looking at 2 million people coming out and then another 2 million people coming out to the streets, what city in the world has that kind of commitment for freedom and democracy? I think the world, I'm very proud to be a Hong Konger. I'm very proud that we are standing up for what is right.
Let's talk about the extradition proposal. It was put out by Connie Lam for consideration. It was temporarily withdrawn, but the pro-democracy group, the pro-freedom groups in Hong Kong are expecting that the extradition bill be dropped completely and never considered again. Can you explain to our listeners the insidiousness of this extradition bill and what it would mean not just to Hong Kongers, but literally to anybody who might be transiting or visiting in Hong Kong?
Okay, so basically, Hong Kong has never allowed the transfer of potential criminal defendants to mainland China to face trial. So we put in this firewall deliberately between Hong Kong and mainland China because we don't trust the legal system in China. And they are trying to remove that firewall by the passage of this extradition bill so that people in future, including American citizens who are transiting through Hong Kong, who are working in Hong Kong or simply having a holiday, could be arrested by the authorities and then be transported to China to face criminal trial. Now, this is a very sensitive subject. The Hong Kong people were very angry that they're trying to rush through this bill. Despite all the, you know, legislative procedures that they should have observed, they rushed through this bill. Despite a million people taking to the streets, they still try to pass this bill until they realize that they cannot do it, that the Hong Kong people are so angry, they're up in arms, saying no to the government. So I think the American angle here is that, of course, as I said, the American interest, there are billions of dollars of investment in Hong Kong, and there are millions of American travelers going through Hong Kong every year. So I think we have to be understanding of the international community sentiment. So all the Western governments spoke out. Americans spoke out, Canadians, Australian, the EU, the UK, Germany, they all told the Hong Kong government, don't do this thing. This is stupid. Please reconsider. But they refused to listen.
And it's still in the queue. It could come back under certain conditions, couldn't it?
Well, you know, Carrie Lam has said time and again that, okay, the bill is dead. Dead as a dead is, you know, it's not going to come back. Then the demands become even more reasonable. So we're saying to you, just withdraw again. Put it off the table. And that is, if you think the bill is dead, then why don't you just withdraw it? The level of trust between the Hong Kong people and the Hong Kong government is not exactly very high.
The Chinese government has accused the United States of being responsible for the current crisis in Hong Kong. saying that we have, in fact, incited chaos. How do you and your colleagues feel about that?
I think that we are hopeful that the situation will be resolved as President Trump said, in a humane way, that it would be great if we could achieve the things that we're hoping to achieve, which is the five demands, and also including within it the universal suffrage that we're talking about.
So let's just, I want to categorize these expectations. First is the complete withdrawal of the extradition bill from the legislative process. Next is the retraction of the riot characterization, because there has been, people have been arrested, taken into custody, rioters. The release and exoneration of arrested protesters, because in some cases they're held right now without due process. Very important, and it's in any free society, the establishment of an independent commission of inquiry into police conduct and the use of force during the protests. And then, as we talked about before, true universal suffrage, not one where the communist government puts up a bunch of stooge candidates that everybody's forced to vote for. That's not real freedom. And these are very simple, and these are really part of the expectations within the basic law. Nobody's asking for anything that's special and above. I think there is resolution, would you say, that Hong Kong is part of the PRC, and at some point in time, I think it's 2047, there is more of a merger that's expected to take place at that time. This isn't necessarily an independence movement, but it is to that principle of one country, two systems, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you put it correctly, that the Hong Kong people is demanding for fairness, due process, and democratic reform. All these values are, you know, we have in common with the rest of the world who believe in these values. And the important about the Hong Kong story, Bruce, is that Hong Kong is now standing at the forefront of the contest between two different worldviews. There are those who believe in freedom, democracy, and the rule of law. And there are those who believe in an authoritarian system. Hong Kong is now at the center of that contest. We're not asking people to take sides between, U.S. or China. We're asking people to choose the kind of international system that we want to see the world inherit. Do we want a rule-based, fair, democratic, free system or not? And that is why the Hong Kong people deserve the support of the international community, because I think they're fighting for the right kind of system that we should have going forward.
Dennis and Solomon, thank you very much for taking time out to join us today. I stand in admiration of your courage and of your determination, Dennis, standing up for the rights of your fellow Hong Kongers for these basic freedoms that are so important wherever men and women live in this world, to have these basic freedoms, which don't come from necessarily from the government. They are God-given. And I wish you every bit of luck. I hope you can join us again soon. And I hope the next time we talk that things will be back to normal in Hong Kong, which is one of the most dynamic and unbelievable cities in the world. So thank you both for joining us. It's been great having you on the show.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed our top flight guests who joined us today on Inside Track: Andy Puzder, Dennis Quoke, and Solomon Yu. And thanks to our great sponsors, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, and Corazon Cabinets. I know each of these owners. They advertise on Inside Track because they support the ideas we discuss on the show every week. I urge you to support them. Please come back and join us next week for a special Labor Day weekend show. Until then, for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash, wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon.